educational achievement in the United States, making them more prepared for a modern government than young men are. The past 40 years has also created a new demographic. Women now have educations and connections, they have skills, often they have money, and the people who are now in the boomer generation and slightly below it are the first generation of American women to have 20 to 30 years after their children leave home to invent a second career. Many of them are turning to issues they care about, including political organizing. Indeed, so nervous are MAGA Republican leaders about women's political roles that they're trying to throw women out of political power altogether. The House passed the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility, or the SAVE Act, which would require all American voters to prove they are citizens by presenting documentation in person when registering to vote or updating their voter registration information. But the kicker is that your official identification has to match your current name. That means that it would disfranchise as many as 69 million American women who do not have passports and whose birth certificates are not in their current married names. That SAVE Act, I think, dovetails with the extraordinary misogyny that has come to dominate the MAGA Republican Party. And I'm going to argue that it is not an accident that the current attempt in the United States to overthrow democracy presents as an attack on American women. American women created and then maintained the American state the Trump administration is currently dismantling. Whether they will save it and realize the government Francis Perkins set out to establish 90 years ago, a government based in the reality that the community is the centerpiece of American society, or whether they won't, is the story of America not just in this moment, but for our future. And I always like to point out that it's worth remembering that the mythological cowboy never stuck around. He actually rode off into the sunset and left the people behind to govern the community. Thank you very much.
One of the things we keep reading in the newspapers today is how unprecedented everything that the Trump administration has been doing over the last few months is. And I wonder if you as the historian can take a bit of a step back for us and separate out a little bit the things that you really think are unprecedented about what we've been seeing in the last few months.
It's dizzying, isn't it? So I am one of the people who called it a constitutional crisis from very early days. And the reason for that, and the reason I was impatient with those who did not, is because our Constitution is really very clear. And the clarity of where the government power comes from is also quite clear. And it comes from we the people, which might be worth picking up. But in our Constitution, there's three main articles. So when someone talks about Article 2 powers, that's what they're talking about, is what's in that. Article 1 sets up the lawmaking bodies of the United States government, and that is the House of Representatives and Congress and the Senate that are the legislative body. That is the only body in the federal government that can write a law, that can make a law. And the Article II powers are the powers of the president. And the president's duty is to execute the laws, make sure that they are carried out in good faith. So the minute that the Trump administration got into power and withheld the appropriations that had been made by Congress for the U.S. Agency for International Development, which is a congressionally established agency, he was taking the power of Congress, one of our three branches of government, and relegating it to himself. That is a constitutional crisis that is explicitly against the law, and according to the 1974 Impoundment Control Act, which said to Richard Nixon, you can't do this. This is what Trump was impeached for in 2019 when he withheld money that had been appropriated for the Ukraine's military. And that right out of the box was the first thing that was unprecedented. But since then, of course, we have the problem of the fact that the Trump administration is operating outside the Constitution. They're not just breaking the laws, they're acting extra-constitutionally, which makes things really difficult because we have systems set up for when people break the laws. We don't have systems set up for when people say, I'm going to pull this billionaire off the street, give him access to all Americans' data, and you know, good luck with that. So in doing so, in working outside the Constitution, they have created many different places in which they have broken laws, which is going to make it very hard for them to back down. And then the other thing is the quite deliberate destruction of the different pieces of our Bill of Rights that protect liberties. And those are ramping up on a daily basis with the idea, I think, of overawing people so they don't fight back. But so far, it's had the opposite effect. A lot of people who otherwise wouldn't be paying very close attention notice when a graduate student gets kidnapped off the streets and sent to prison in Louisiana.
Yeah, and I think your description of a constitutional crisis is one way of trying to express there's something really unprecedented about this. There's something urgent. It is some kind of emergency. One of the other ways that prominent historians have been trying to do that, like Ruth Ben-Ghiat or Tim Snyder, is through comparisons with fascism. And I wonder if you could just reflect a little bit about whether you think is that useful or not, or do you want to keep rooting it as you do really in American history?
There's two ways to answer that, and one of the ways in which we're in quite unusual territory for the United States is we have in power a group of people who are actively trying to destroy democracy. Now, we've had that in the States before. If you think about the American South from about 1874 to about 1965, those were one-party states in which not everybody enjoyed equality before the law. In fact, very few people enjoyed equality before the law. But this is the first time we actually have people in America doing it. So I'm one of those annoying people who doesn't like the word fascism because fascism has a number of economic policies that the Trump administration is really not embracing in favor of authoritarianism. And in that, we're in a new moment, I think, and this is not new to me saying this. There's a number of people who study, for example, international crime, who noticed within about 15 years ago that the criminals around the world are working together with political leaders and sometimes lawmakers to create a new kind of power structure, a criminal power structure around the entire globe. And so if you think about what the Trump administration is trying to do, to me, it looks much more like somebody like Viktor Orban in Hungary, who of course has a much smaller country than the United States is, but Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, for example, literally took a number of the laws that they've put in place in Florida from laws that Viktor Orban put in place in Hungary, and the right-wing conservative political action committee, not committee, conference, has of course spoken, had Viktor Orban come speak, and they have had their Tucker Carlson go and interview Orban a number of times. So when I think about what I see in the United States right now, when I look at what the Trump administration is doing, I think the models are much more the kind of model you see in other countries than even in some place like the American South. So that's the direction that I would look. And while fascism is a very useful term for the destruction of rights and liberties, I study the economy, so I'm kind of like, that's not quite what he's doing, because if you look at the tariffs, for example, the sheer caprice of them is something that you'd have a much harder time getting through a fascist system than you would through an authoritarian system. So you can call it fascist if you want, but I'm much more into authoritarianism.
I think there are uses that many of these authors have for calling it fascism, which is, I think, try and draw attention to this as a crisis, right? And that's part of it. But there are also a huge number of distinctions. The way that I've thought about it is what Robert Paxton talks about, where one of the most famous people talking about fascism, his view has been, we could call this fascist, but it's also not helpful politically. It doesn't really get us anywhere. And I think that's actually quite helpful. So the way that I've been thinking about it, to move to my next question, is to draw on what Daniel Ziblatt, political scientist, has been talking about when he's been describing what Trump is aiming at as something more akin to competitive authoritarianism. There'll still be elections, but it's going to be harder and harder harder for the Democrats to win. So I'd love to hear a little bit more of your reflections on that, whether it's comparisons with Hungary or Turkey. Do you see competitive authoritarianism as a better description of where the U.S. might be heading?
I do, and I love his work. And yes, the concept of competitive authoritarianism is that, yes, there will always be elections, but you already know who's going to win one of them. And that's the same kind of things you saw in Russia or in Hungary are exactly the same things you're seeing here, an attempt really to crack down on the media, to delegitimize opponents, political opponents. But to maybe add a little bit to something that he said, I have been fascinated for years now by the concept that is associated with Russian political theorists, but I have never been convinced that it came entirely from Russian political theorists. And that is the concept of virtual technology or virtual politics. And that's the idea of creating a false reality around which voters come to cast their votes. So they believe they're voting for something they are not, which if you're following American politics right now, you don't have to go real far to look at people going, he's doing what with the tariffs? You know, what is he? That's not what I voted for. But that idea of using a fake reality to convince people to vote away their own democracy, one of the reasons I don't think it is associated, I don't associate it only with Russia, is because that's really been something that the Republican Party has been doing now since at least 1978. And so the cross-pollinization of political operatives between America and what, you know, at the time was called the torturers' lobby in the 1980s, and then in the 1990s after the fall of the Soviet Union, strikes me as having a lot of commonalities between the United States and countries like Russia or countries like Belarus or Ukraine, who have faced a similar situation of political operatives convincing people of a fake reality, of a virtual politics. And in this moment, one of the things, if you read these books, it's really interesting, is they talk about how you destabilize a democratic population and how you can get them to vote away their democracy and how they become yours and how you start to scoop everything up. But they never talk about what happens when a people realizes that's happened to them. That, to me, is the interesting moment. Because in the United States, what I think we're seeing is the rise of a reality-based media that rejects the same kinds of fake stories that you see even to some degree in the legacy media, but certainly in right-wing media. And you also see the reassertion of reality. But I also suspect that when people who have sold their political and perhaps personal identities to that fake image discover that they were sold a bill of goods, they're going to be angry. And that, I think, is what we're going to see in the United States. If you know, one of the reasons I read Reddit a lot is people vent on Reddit, but they vent intelligently on Reddit, unlike on Twitter. And they vent about why they're mad. And a lot of people are really mad right now who were full-fledged MAGAs before.
So I want to dig into this question of virtual reality. I would love to hear from you your perspective of how Republicans have built this. What are the channels that they've used? So expanding a little bit more on, there's the Fox News, but the talk radio. Tell us a little bit more about your 40-year potted history of how Republicans have created this virtual reality.
You see the rise, really, with Reagan, although the roots of it are in Richard Nixon's 1968 campaign, of creating this image. And this, the Nixon campaign does it very deliberately, and the guy who runs it in the Nixon campaign is Roger Ailes, who's going to come back in just a minute. So you get Nixon, and then you get the frustration of the people who are trying to get rid of the U.S. government, the activist U.S. government, with the fact that every time they keep warning people that they shouldn't like this government, they're like, what are you talking about? We have union protections, we have jobs, we have roads, you know, we like this government. And they got frustrated because they felt that no matter what they said, people voted for the other side. And so they began to really push the idea that their point of view had to be represented in the American media. But the problem was that we had this something called the Fairness Doctrine that said that if you were making an argument in the media, it had to be supported by facts, and you had to represent the other side as well. So in order to make sure that their point of view, which was based in Christianity and based in getting rid of regulations and a social safety safety net and taxes. In order to make sure that that was available, they really pressured Reagan to put on our Federal Communications Commission a group of people who believed in what we called movement conservatism. They called themselves conservatives, but they were not conservative. They were radical, but they were a political movement. So that's what movement conservatism is. So in 1987, we lose the Fairness Doctrine. And we lose the Fairness Doctrine just as FM radio is coming on really effectively, so that AM radio stations need ears. And they start to run shock jocks, and the shock jocks figure out that politics sells. So Rush Limbaugh does not start as a political shock jock. He becomes a political shock jock. So by 1988, you have Rush Limbaugh with a national show. And then, of course, you get the Fox News Channel in 1996, which brings that image to television. And, of course, that's run by Roger Ailes. You know, this is a theme. But to that concept of creating this right-wing media and the ecosystem around it has grown since then, and you know the rest. You know the fall of local media because of the concentration of newspapers, for example, and the overcapitalization of media and so on. But let me just jump forward to this moment, because I think this moment is so interesting. We know now that one of the reasons that President Donald Trump was able to essentially not do any media, not do any interviews or so on in the 2024 election was because they had created an entirely alternative media. And that media was not just the things that people like me were watching, like Newsmax or OAN or the Fox News Channel, or the things that you have heard of. They were paying influencers on politics adjacent things like nutrition podcasts, yoga podcasts, the Tradwife Instagram things, all that stuff. So they were permeating a group of people that the rest of us weren't even paying attention to. I think we're in a whole new world. And one of the things that you are seeing, if you're watching this stuff closely now, is that people in the reality-based community have figured this out. And so if you're watching social media closely now, you will see the real cross-pollinization of people working in the reality-based media and the real attempt to throw up new, younger, politics-adjacent voices.
What lessons from history offer us hope about reversing the immense influence of ultra-wealth on controlling a democracy?
I'm glad you specified wealth, because there are a number of studies of how one reclaims a democracy from an autocracy. But the thing about the extraordinary wealth in the United States right now is that we have a very clear pattern for overcoming that, because this is exactly what the United States looked like during what we knew as the Gilded Age, or the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And what was key to that was not only the obvious things like the rise of a new media, which of course we're seeing now. We had the exact same thing happen in the late 19th century with the rise of magazines like McClure's Magazine, which you may have heard of and which is available online, by the way, that said to people who were not otherwise paying attention or were simply reading the legacy media, you know, hey, do you know what J.D. Rockefeller's doing with oil and how he's destroying small businesses? Or, hey, do you know how the cities of Minneapolis, Ray Stanner Baker wrote about Minneapolis and how Minneapolis was corrupt and so on? And that engaged a lot of people in the political process that weren't otherwise engaged. And you saw the rise of things like the Alliance Movement and the Populist Movement from this new media, much of which was ephemeral, and we don't have it anymore, which breaks my heart. You know, South Dakota had a huge range of Alliance newspapers. That's where the Alliance began, and they're all gone. So there is the rise of new media, and there is the rise of increasing language against those politicians. Because everybody writes to me and says, well, why should I complain to my Republican politicians? They're not going to change anything. I'm like, no, of course they're not. Ron Johnson is not suddenly going to start voting for the Democrats. But lots of people would like to get elected to replace Ron Johnson, and they will listen to what you are saying. And you're already seeing this around the United States right now. All kinds of people throwing their hats into the ring, new faces and new ideas for the midterm elections and then eventually for the next presidential election. But that's not the only place that you see the rise of a pushback against the extraordinary wealth that has garnered power in the United States in this era, but also in the last. The humanities are really important. music and art are really important because they give voices to people who are otherwise excluded from that political system. And if you think about the late 19th century and the parallels to the present, we had new kinds of clothing, we had new voices, we had new foods, we had new languages, we had new art. And I always point to the Armory exhibit of 1913 in New York City, the New York City Armory exhibit, which is always heralded as the rise of modern art and how dramatically that changed the way people saw the world. But it's not like they started painting in 1912 for the 1913 Armory. That came out of the late 19th century. The new music, jazz and ragtime and cowboy poetry and all the new forms of artistic expression created new ways to talk about communities and about pushing back against those very wealthy people who were using the government for themselves. At the same time in that era, you got huge numbers of social groups like the Odd Fellows and the Masons and the fraternal and sororal organizations. And they began to provide the kinds of support for individuals that the government was not doing. But they made it clear they would like those things. So, for example, the Knights of Columbus at one point, you know, were providing insurance and death benefits for their members. So you start to see all these new organizations and these new ideas, new languages, as I say, and music and so on. And you see the reality that the current government is not answering the needs of any except a very few. I would argue the exact same thing is happening in the United States today. All of the things I just said you've seen parallels to, including the rise of new organizations, but you're not seeing them in the streets so much as you're seeing them on social media, where, you know, people have millions of individuals who come together to support a cause or a person or whatever. And for me, one of the most dramatic news in the United States in the last at least 5 years was the popular reaction to the shooting of the UnitedHealthcare CEO in Manhattan. TikTok was a light for weeks. There are images that circulate around the United States of the shooter as a saint. You know, people are paying his legal bills. That lionization of a man who took on the healthcare system, but really the wealth that is dominating American society, indicated to me a powder keg.
Yeah. As we're on a university campus, I want to ask you the question about the Trump administration's cuts to university funding, canceling grants for the National Endowment for Humanities, National Science Foundation, you name it.
You have to start by remembering that there's three factions of MAGA that are currently operating out of the White House. And Donald Trump is a figurehead for those. He is not in control of this administration. I believe that. Not that they're tying him up in the basement. But he has admitted in many ways that he is not the one calling the shots. So he has said, for example, that he was not the person who signed the order that put the 1798 Alien Enemies Act into use for rending migrants to El Salvador. Now, maybe he signed it, maybe he didn't, but in any case, that was a really big deal for the president to say, I don't know what you're talking about. And the number of times he said, I don't know, I didn't have anything to do with that, you got to talk to somebody who did, when he's the president, suggests that there's a problem there. But those three factions are struggling over controlling the administration, and that would be the Broligarchs, who are, you can think of them as Elon Musk, I'm giving you the shorthand. There's the Project 2025 people, who is Russell Vogt, who's the director of the Office of Management and Budget, that is really putting that stuff in place very quietly. He's really running under the radar, but he's the one who's really getting stuff accomplished. And then there is the sort of Hungarian faction, which is being run out of the deputy White House chief of staff position, and that's Stephen Miller, and he's working with Christine Noem, who is the Secretary of Homeland Security. They're the ones who want to get rid of everybody with brown or black skin, and they're the ones who are behind the migrant stuff. So you got those three people going on, but it's really important to remember to take this. Here's my onion. I'm taking you in the onion. It's really important to remember that of those three groups, Stephen Miller wants a very powerful government right away. But the Project 2025 people and the broligarchs want to take American government down to the dirt. They want to get rid of the government. They want to get rid of the health care. They want to get rid of science. They want to get rid of Social Security. They want to get rid of Medicare. They want to get rid of Medicaid. They want to get rid of everything, and they want to get rid of education, because they believe that all of those things have been tainted by the government I was talking about, what they call a liberal government or a secular government. And that it's not just a question of replacing people and putting somebody else in power that votes Republican. They want to get rid of those things altogether. And that's what you're watching happen right now. So when they're going after education, they're not just mad at Columbia or at Harvard or at whatever. They are literally trying to destroy the current educational system the way it exists. Now, what's interesting to me, and I mentioned Russell Vogt there, is they're not talking a lot about what they want to put in its place, are they? Now, Stephen Miller wants to control a strong government, and both of those groups also want to control a strong government. Elon Musk wants to have government contracts so he can get to Mars. And then the Project 2025 people want a strong government so they can impose religious rule. Stephen Miller wants a strong government so he can have a white supremacist, you know, white people get everything government. But they don't agree with each other, and they're disagreeing about how to implement that. So one of the things to be watching from up here is the stresses within that White House, not just the actions, but what they're trying to do going forward and where there are divisions among them.
Heather, you wanted a small final question, so I'll give it to you. This series is called What It Means to Be an American. Tell us in three words, what do you think it means to be an American?
Oh, that's so easy. We have hope.
You were just listening to Heather Cox Richardson on cowboy authoritarianism in America. She spoke at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver on April 10, 2025, as part of its What It Means to Be an American series. Heather Cox Richardson is professor of history at Boston College. Her newsletter, Letters from an American, reaches more than a million readers. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Naomi Klein, Gabor Mate, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program and for Howard Zinn's classic book, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to UBC's School of Public Policy and Global Affairs and the Chan Center for the Performing Arts. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
This is Forbes Avenue, WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Aubriana Bench, and I'm here with Ben Carter.
Hi there.
Do you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, what you do?
I'm the scene shop supervisor in the School of Drama here at Carnegie Mellon, and also an instructor teaching a few classes.
How long have you been here for?
Just finishing my 35th year.
During my brief research into what you do, I saw that you are a CMU alum.
Yes, it's true. I graduated in 1984.
Oh, what made you decide to come back here?
They called me. I was originally a drama student for a year, and then I switched to sculpture and graduated from there. And went out and worked for 3 years, and then they called me out of the blue and asked me to come back and teach. So the rest is history.
I heard through the grapevine, because we know each other, that you have experience working on feature films.
Yes, it's true. Yes, that is correct.
I saw that it was like construction, special props, and consulting. How did you get introduced to doing this?
One of the things that the sculpture world teaches you is that there's no jobs in the sculpture world if you get a sculpture degree. But what it does teach you also is that there are businesses out there that use all the same technologies and techniques and materials and strange problem solving strategies that dovetail very nicely into that. And the one business that I still had kind of a background interest in was entertainment, motion pictures, television, etc. And when I started here at CMU, that is what this department is. And then because of my woodworking experience, I immediately got a job on a movie building specialty stunt props for Night of the Living Dead, which was being shot here in Pittsburgh. And we had to do a custom railing for somebody to fall through. And that was a perfect segue from one discipline into the other. And from there, it was just, oh, you can do that? Oh, you've done that? Next thing you know, here we are many, many years later. So
that's really cool. How many films have you done since then?
20-some, but I stopped doing it about 10 years ago because it was too many other things going on. But it will consume your life completely. And I was doing it as a side job on top of my full-time job. And it's easily a full-time job on its own, especially if there's more than one movie in town, then you just don't sleep. So, yeah, I mean, I could go back over and count how many it is if somebody really needed an actual number, but it's over 20, so.
What was it like going from that experience and then coming back to CMU? Like, how are maybe, like, the people different in that field and then?
No, we are that field. The drama department, we train those people to go out into that business. So it's the same bunch of crazies that you deal with, and the same ridiculous deadlines and the same budgets, the same lack of sleep, the same intensity of work, attention to detail. It's very, very, very rewarding and very, very fast-paced. And our department is very, very much the same way, too. So our students are really, really pushed really, really hard to get the best out of them. And that is what the entertainment industry is very, very much based on, that mentality too. So they really expect people to just show up and give 100% or more all the time, every day until the show's over. And then everybody goes in their own way, and then somebody else comes in and starts it all. And that's just to get things done that fast and that accurately again and again and again. There's very, very little room for taking a breath or making any mistakes. So that's what we train.
Yeah, so it's just different place, but same exact type of people, same vibe.
It's very, very similar. And the big, big difference is the movie business pays so much better.
What films did you do? Like, maybe what was one of your favorites that you worked on?
We've done bits and pieces on a lot of them, but one of the ones that we had the most work on was a film called Striking Distance. It was a Bruce Willis film that they shot here a while back in 1992. And that was just an entire summer of not all day, every day, because I was working here doing pre-college as well. We were doing special props on that movie, so they just needed various things like a huge pile of artificial rock cocaine. They needed a rubber shotgun that they could smack somebody with. It was shot on the rivers, so they had a police boat that they needed to have completely outfitted with all the electronics and lights and siren and all that stuff, so we did all that. They had a van that they just handed us a, a blank van and said, hey, turn this into a broadcast media van. So we had to put all the antennas and all the telescoping satellite dishes, which we all had to build everything from scratch too. Yeah. So it's a really wide variety of stuff that they ask you to do. And you never know what you're going to get, because, and that's the nature of the business too, is they just, they have something in their mind and they show you a napkin sketch and they say, can you build this? And then they say, how much? And then, and you kind of come up with an idea how you're going to build it, what it's going to be made out of. And very oftentimes you haven't used these materials before and you just have to sort of trust yourself and just throw yourself into it. And somehow or other, we were never late. They always loved it. I have no idea looking back on it how that ever happened, but it's really, it's so fun and it's so stressful. And it's really neat compared to the theater world, because you can always go back years later to this day. I can go on YouTube, pull up any one of those movies and any one of those segments and scroll through the segments of those movies and show anybody any of the props that we built, if it made it to the movie, because a lot of things you make, they end up on the cutting room floor. They get edited out for whatever time reasons or whatever. But anything that did make the movie, you can always go on there and say, scroll through and say, yeah, there it is. There is Ben Affleck stabbing Matt Damon with this knife that you made. So it's really fun. And there's a history. It's documented. So that's what I like about it, compared to doing theater work where everything goes in the dumpster.
Yeah.
So.
You keep saying we. Is the we like you and other people at CMU, or did you work with a group?
When we were doing movie stuff, I was an independent contractor always.
Okay.
Pretty much. So I didn't join a union or anything. We just had our own shop at home. My wife and I were basically the company. She was a painter more. She would do the custom painting work on things. And I would do all the structural, actual construction of everything. And then periodically, we did a movie called The Piano Lesson, an August Wilson movie for Hallmark Channel. And they needed a carved piano. And it all had to be carved from scratch. You know, they gave us drawings that they wanted it to match. And there was just too many hours involved carving it. So at that time, I was still connected with the wood shop where I used to work. And we did a lot of hand carving at the wood shop. So I called one of my friends there and hired him to come in and help me. He was a really good master wood carver. So we spent a lot of time together just carving all these wooden panels all over the piano. So depending on who you're working, what your project is, who you're working with, or who you're working for, you can tap back into your former or present lives and get different people with different skill sets to jump in on the project and then jump back out again. And if they're really busy and they don't want to do it, that could be a real problem, but usually you just show them a stack of money and they're like, oh yeah, I have time for that.
Olav, your son, told me that you have a piece of glass from The Silence of the Lambs.
It's a piece of Lexan, yeah.
Yeah. How did you do a lot of props for that?
No, I didn't even work on that. We were on another project at that time when that was being filmed here. But it was a piece of Hannibal Lecter's cage, the Lexan panels that somebody had made for the movie, because they don't generally go to the store and buy those things. Most of what you see is made, custom made for stuff like that. And when they tear down sets, a lot of it gets thrown away. A lot of it, if it's very interesting little pieces, people tend to hang on to as mementos of their experience, or if they think that maybe they can use it for something. Well, one of my good friends from back in the day, Lou Taylor, who was the construction coordinator on that movie, he took that with him, one of those panels. Who knows what happened to the other ones, but he took it with him and then brought it onto another movie that I was working called, a Stephen King movie called Dark Half, that was shot here. And they needed that panel as a backing panel in a shower door so they could slam against the shower door without breaking the shower door. And when that movie wrapped, he just happened to have it and said, I know how to do that. I have just a thing for that. We can shine light through it and you can't see it. And then when that movie wrapped, he didn't want that thing anymore. I was helping clean up and I said, can I have it? And they said, get it out of here. So now that's in my basement. So you do tend to keep things that are kind of unusual and neat. I was going to make a dining table out of it. But I never did.
Okay, I wanted to know the story behind that because I'm just a big horror movie nerd. But I'm talking to Ben Carter, instructor at the theater department in CMU, and I just wanted to keep talking to you about what you were doing in the film scene here. You said that you would do stuff for props, like, in your backyard. Is that where you would mostly do stuff?
Or in our,
like,
shop, in our home. We had at that point, when we first started doing it, we had bought a building down on the north side, an old salad dressing factory, and turned it into our house. So we had we had an apartment, we had a shop, we had a garage, and of course a music room, because, you know, you have to have a jammer. So yeah. And the shop was a pretty good sized shop. So there was, you know, a metalworking area, a casting and mold making area, a carpentry area, a drafting area, and there was just every, because you have to use so many different types of technologies and tools and materials, coming back to the sculpture world, it's all those things all just came back together into an actual job that actually works, that actually makes money, that's objective. The sculpture world and art world is completely subjective, and the whole value of everything you do is completely up to the viewer or the art gallery owner, whatever, which is really, really kind of unknown, and you can't count on paying your bills that way. So yeah. All those same technologies and all those same materials and techniques and everything, they all translate directly into entertainment, where you need all that same stuff, and there it is, and it worked. And you can say for sure it's more like an engineering job, where you can say, yes, that actually fulfilled the project goals successfully, and here is your paycheck, moving on, instead of being just sort of surreal and weird, which is the art world. So I
just want to wrap up what we've talked about. Based on when you were involved in it, how was the Pittsburgh film scene in general? I know we've talked a lot about it. I know we've said it's kind of not very different from CMU because it's all the same people, but based on, you know, when you were there, how was it?
At CMU, you mean?
In the Pittsburgh film scene.
Well, it's been going on for 100 years. So,
yeah.
And it kind of comes and goes depending on a lot of different things, you know, tax incentives and things like that. And other cities are always trying to get the money and get the business to come here. And we'll go a year sometimes without something, and then sometimes we'll have three or four films being shot here at once. And right now, Mayor of Kingstown is shooting again. We just drove by the prison today, and there's a row of Haddad's trucks, which is, you know, the local people that support all the logistics of that. So they're still filming away again. I haven't committed my life to the industry, so I'm really sort of superficially involved in it. Like, I would just jump in and jump out as needed. I never, ever once had to make a phone call and say, hey, does anybody have any work? It's more like I'd be doing something already and somebody would call. Or once people know what you do, they don't want to do job interviews and research. They want to call someone and say, hey, I'm in town, I don't know anybody who does this. And it's relatively small community in this town, about in the movie industry, so everybody knows everybody. So if somebody says, who does special props, there's only a couple people that do it. Now, I don't do it anymore. Unfortunately, there's a couple other people around that took over that and do it on a really large scale. And we still stay in touch and can compare ideas and things now and then, too. But you can't really say it's a thriving industry. There was a point where it was a few years ago, probably 20 years ago, a lot of local carpenters quit their construction jobs and just joined the union and became full-time movie carpenters. And then that's not a good way to do it. You make lots of money for, you know, 6 or 9 months or something like that, and then that movie wraps and they're gone, and then you don't know if another one's coming. Yet you've quit your jobs and you don't know what you're going to do, and then maybe you take on another construction job and another movie comes in. So sometimes they overlap too. So, like, you're really heavy deep into one and another one starts and they want you to come work for them, yet you're already signed on to this one, and they don't really care if one is already going. So the industry is just like that. And in Pittsburgh, where we're not really historically like LA or something, which is like known for being a movie town, outside of Pittsburgh, it's not as reliable as a source of income, for instance, if you want to dedicate your life and family and your bills to it. So doing it as a subcontractor occasionally was really, really fun and really nice. So it was. Yeah. It's too much now between, you know, life and family and puppies and Airbnbs and things like that. No more.
Yeah. I'm talking with Ben Carter, a theater instructor at CMU. And I want to talk a bit about what you do at CMU now.
Yeah.
Because if you can't hear, we're in the scene shop. Lots of background noise, people talking, movement around. And you have machines here that you can kind of do stuff with. And
Yeah, the nature of a scene shop is kind of interesting because what we do in the theater is we basically make a microcosm of the real world on stage. So it's all the same materials. It's all, you know, plumbing and electrical and carpentry and metalworking and welding and machining and all the same things that you would have in the real world, except on a much smaller scale. So we have to do bits and pieces of all the things. So if you had to hire a plumber or an electrician or a carpenter to do your house, we have to do all those things in little bits and pieces, but they all have to be just as functional as they would be in your real house, but on stage. And then to support that, our shop has to have the same capabilities as if you were building an entire house, basically, all the same stuff. So we have tons of carpentry equipment. This whole side of the shop is basically for woodworking. That whole side of the shop is basically for metalworking. So we build more and more and more sets out of metals, mostly steel these days. And that all depends on the designer, we never know. So since we do things on a large scale, we like to buy machinery that's sort of scaled up for that we get from the industrial world, the manufacturing sector, basically. So our machines aren't what you would see like in a high school theater shop. They're pulled right from real industrial shops that are designed to run 24 hours a day.
Richard is pointing to the hamburger, like right above your
head.
Okay,
so the hamburger, it's a cheeseburger, actually. They're one of the classes they do here in the advanced paint class is they have to do a sculpture out of something three-dimensionally. And sometimes they're very large. You'll see, like, there's a mastodon head over there and a dinosaur head up there. They make them as part of their graduate thesis projects. And they're usually big, and they're very fancy, and they're super well made. And they graduate, and they can't take that on a plane. So sometimes they just dumpster them, and sometimes it's just like, no, we really want that. So up, it gets hung on the wall or hung on the ceiling, and then that hamburger and that car, that was actually a prop from a show. But they loved it so much they couldn't bear to scrap it, so they hung it on the wall. We only have so much wall space, you know, so. But like the cheeseburger was just so funny, you know, that we couldn't do anything with it. And at least twice, people have come to us and said, we heard you have a giant cheeseburger. And one was a hamburger shop that wanted to borrow it for their opening of their hamburger shop so that they could have it. And somebody else needed it for some show somewhere. So we bring in our lift and we bring it up and take down the cheeseburger. It goes in a crate and goes away. But that's the kind of thing, if it's that cool and it's that easy to hang on to, it's just fun. And it's just, the whole industry is kind of, it's so silly. You know, the whole theater industry and everything, it's all fake and it's all silly. And sometimes you get to hang on to really cool stuff like that.
Yeah. When my brother and I came in here to make a sign for the film we were working on last summer, you graciously let us use your CNC machine.
Yeah.
So do you want to maybe take me on a walk throughout the shop and maybe show us what your favorite machine is?
Sure, of course. Well, like I said, this is the woodworking area. We have the usual table saw and radial arm saw. So we have things for processing sheet goods like plywood and lumber. That's this whole side of the room. And that whole side of the room is the paint shop. So we build everything down here and then we send it all down there one way or another. Sometimes it's too big and sometimes we actually have to build it and then just ship it directly into the theater. Like this is all for Titanic. So
this staircase is going to be in the set for Titanic?
Yeah. And you see it's all bolted to the floor now so that they can run up and down on it and whatever. But you notice that it also really, really quickly comes apart so that we can take it in pieces. Sometimes we'll build a huge, huge set in here that can't come apart and we'll put it all on wheels. And then we open that giant door. There's another giant door that goes onto the stage. And then we get 20 people just to roll the entire thing in there in one piece. So sometimes we do little tiny things. Sometimes we do things that are 50 feet long. That's the nature of this business. So we would rather not have this monstrosity in the middle of the shop. But that's what we do. Yeah. So that, it has to go somewhere. It doesn't fit anywhere else. So over here, so that's, like I said, that's all plywood, soft materials relatively that we cut over here. And this is all for metal. This is a milling machine that we're currently set up. We have a computer-controlled aspect of this machine that we can put a piece of material in there and then do some programming, and it will do a bunch of processing to the piece of metal for you according to the program you did. So right now we have it set up to do that, as we were making some brackets for the lighting department to hang this lighting instruments on the front of the stage that don't exist. So they come to us and say, hey, we have this weird application for this stuff, and these things that we need, nobody makes. And that's kind of the nature of this business, is that people are always saying, we want you to fill this weird gap that nobody has ever filled before. And this is the materials and this is the needs you have to do for it. So can anybody make that? Yeah. So this is one of my classes, advanced fabrication class. They come to us and say, hey, can your class make these weird things? I say, well, absolutely. So whatever the curriculum is for the day gets changed. And then we go off to make these weird things for them.
Yeah.
So we also use this for other things in class too. We just happen to be using it right now for that. I can show you an example of that over here.
Sure.
So there's also under there, there's a metal lathe. If we have to make custom round things, we do a lot of automation, a lot of computer generated automation and winches and things that move things around the stage. And we do a lot of adaptation of mechanical components. Like they'll bring us a sprocket or a gear or a shaft or a bearing, and they'll say, to make this work, we have to make this go with that, but that hole's too big or this is too small. And if we have to make a hole larger or a shaft smaller, we'll put it on the lathe and turn it down until it fits, what make all the components go together. So not your usual scene shop stuff, but we're not your usual scene shop
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
At the highest level of this industry, if you go out and look at the professional shops, who are doing, you know, the Broadway things and the touring rock and roll shows and things like that, they all have shops that are 10 times this size and way more sophisticated than this, as if it's actually a real manufacturing facility where they're making products. And they're making a product, it's just that product is usually used once or twice, or maybe on a tour or something like that, and then it's just shelved. So, but we have to do it with the same level of intensity and accuracy and tolerance and budgets and speed and all that. So it's a weird hybrid of worlds that collide. So we have metal cutting tools and metal drilling tools, another little miniature version of that milling machine, band saws for cutting metal, belt sanders for grinding metal, things like this iron worker machine, which does a whole bunch of different things. The machine I showed you right there that I had to set up to drill holes, this is one of those brackets. So it drills all those holes, and then we bring it over here and put it in here, and it does all these bends.
Whoa.
We have it all preset to little certain marks. So you set it in there, you push the button, and it bends it up. If you want a sound bite, I'll give you an idea what it sounds like.
Oh yeah.
If I want to clear it in there, if I want to do a bend, this is an extra one. So. And this it's been changed so that angle isn't correct right now. But I mean, that's a general, I mean, this is not a machine like so many other machines and materials that we have in the shop. Nothing has been at all, zero of this has been designed and engineered and built for the entertainment industry. It's all been taken from the manufacturing or construction or R&D or scientific community. One of those sectors, somebody has already made the machinery that we need, and we say, well, we have to make this thing. We need a machine to do that. We have to make enough of them that it's worth spending $80,000 for that machine. And when I started here, nobody had heard of any of this stuff, because we were just building things with hammers and nails and screws and then throwing it away. And,
oh boy.
You know, and that's not how it's done today.
Yeah.
So you have to do things fast and repeatedly, and That's where things like this thing, this CNC router, come in handy, because we have to do huge square foot areas of scenery. So like you see that big, that those carts there with all those pieces of wood on them?
Yeah.
They have a notch cut all the way around the outside of them, and then some slots cut through the middle of them. If we did that by hand, it would take days and days and days of just doing it with a hand router or a saw of some sort, whatever. Well, we can take one of the sheets, fasten it down onto this thing, and it takes about 5 minutes to cut each one, and they're all absolutely perfect.
Do you keep up with what goes on in the drama department these days? Like, do you know about the
show? As I need to. There's a lot of people who, you kind of learn when you stick your nose into situations. There's so much going on, and there's so many people that are so overloaded with work that if you show an interest in something, next thing you know, even if it's a passing interest, next thing you know, you've got more responsibility than you wanted. And yeah. Something is your fault that you just asked a little question about. So I only know what comes through the shop, and I don't care what the designs are anymore. I don't when it leaves this shop, I don't care what happens to it. Basically, I just teach people how to use the tools, what they're actually building or when they need them by, and all that. That's out of my world now. So we just try to get them really prepared to go out in the real world and be really, really active, creative problem solvers, and know, most importantly, to look at a project, no matter what the scale is, and say, this is my skill set. This is what kind of tools we have at this shop. This is what our personnel can do. Can we do that? How long will it take us to do that? Do we need to job portions of this project out to other shops? And maybe it's too much at all. And then eventually, how much will it cost? How long will it take? So the whole idea of most of the students that come through our shop here they're really pushing them to be managers and business owners, project managers. So, and estimators and integrators and logistics people out in on a really large scale stuff. Very few people leave here after spending the money and go back, you know, to be their high school technical director or a regional theater person. Some of them do because that's what they want to do. But once you get exposed to a lot of really, really high-end, really cool stuff here, and you meet a lot of people who have come through here who are now really huge in the industry, and they're going to come back in and say, oh, you want to go work at your high school, do you? Okay, and then they'll say, check this out. Look what we did. Then they blow their minds, and they're like, yeah, actually, I want to do something really huge and really interesting.
I'm sure it's nice for you to just kind of, as you said, be in your own space. And you had your experience with the industry, but now you're just chilling here. But is there anything you want people to know that we haven't talked about?
As far as like what to, you know, parting comments or anything like that, if you go see plays or if you go see movies or if you go see television, if you have any interest in the industry at all, wonder what it, and the only reason I'm in this business is because I always wondered when I watched a movie, how did they do that? Who got to make that thing? That is so cool. And then at some point the door opened for me that said, you can actually do that. And I looked at my tools and my skill set and I said, my gosh, that is actually something that I might be able to do. Mm-hmm. And when I tried that, it was in fact what I wanted to do, and people told me, hey, you're good at this. You know, so it was, next thing you know, we're 35 years later.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Ben Carter, CMU shop instructor.
Yep.
It's super fun being able to work with you. I know I work for DR technically, but
that's
just
right.
Coming in and being able to see you all the time, talk to you
cool.
about the docs.
Appreciate it.
But yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, anything I can do to help, let me know.
Yeah, all right, cool.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh.
You're fierce. You take care of business and don't hold back. Taking care of your health shouldn't be any different. You know when something's off. Don't ignore symptoms like fatigue, joint pain, and rashes. Listen to your body. It could be lupus. We're here to help you take control. Learn how at BeFierceTakeControl.org. Brought to you by the Lupus Foundation of America and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
myth of cowboy individualism became central to the culture of Republican politics. From 1981 to 2021, Republican policies moved more than $50 trillion from the bottom 90% of Americans to the top 1%. And the party stayed in power through media disinformation, voter suppression, gerrymandering, and the flood of money into politics. Those systemic changes to the political system in the United States moved the Republican Party farther and farther and farther right. And the rhetoric of cowboy individualism, as it did so, became more and more extreme.
That's Heather Cox Richardson, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Heather Cox Richardson on cowboy authoritarianism in America. We are at an inflection point. A chill is sweeping the country. We ignore it at our peril. The warning signs are everywhere. Alaska GOP Senator Lisa Murkowski says, "We are all afraid." Massachusetts Democratic Governor Maura Healey says, "The fear is real." New York Times columnist Masha Gessen writes, "America's police state has arrived." Dissent is being criminalized. People are being deported without due process. Court rulings are being ignored. Democracy, civil liberties, and free speech are all under attack. What can be done to reverse cowboy authoritarianism in America? Our guest today is Heather Cox Richardson. She's professor of history at Boston College. She previously taught at MIT. Her newsletter, Letters from an American, reaches more than a million readers. She spoke at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver on April 10, 2025. The moderator is UBC professor Heidi Twarick.